Hello, and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have a very exciting episode where we want to review the latest ACE, that's the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, Type 2 Diabetes Treatment Algorithm. And for those that are not aware, so ACE comes out with their guidelines. The last one was actually in 2023. That was a great update. And we've been eagerly awaiting. There's so many new things happening in the world of diabetes. So we were eager for another update and it just came out. So it's very, very exciting. And Natalie, maybe I'll turn it over to you to just kind of give some top line of what our new guidelines show.
Absolutely. Thanks, Diana. Hello, everyone. Again, I think that the 2026 guidelines, it builds on the 2023 version and incorporates major new evidence with updated complications-focused framework. Why? Because if we only focus on A1C, we're missing it, aren't we? Because people with type 2 diabetes also have challenges with cholesterol, with blood pressure, with often overweight or obese, that the complications can come even with meeting diabetes guidelines, but we have to meet all the guidelines. So really focused on that, really focused on the complications. MASLD and MASH are now recognized as key diabetes-related complications and appear throughout the document, as well as obesity, dysglycemia, and a new diabetes classification pathway. So I think what we need to think about with this is principles of care, pre-diabetes, diabetes classifications, ASCVD risk reduction, comorbidities, complication-centric, glucose-centric pharmacotherapy, insulin initiation and titration early and often. If we can't get to goal, we should be using insulin, obesity pharmacotherapy, and finally, vaccines for persons with diabetes. How did they do that? What did they look at? How do you make a decision? You know, you and I are in clinical practice every day, Diana, and it's like, what am I basing my decisions on? We're basing them on guidelines. But what did this group that wrote these new guidelines look at? All the studies that you and I have been talking about in the last 2+ years, SURMOUNT 2, SURMOUNT OSA, SELECT, STEP, HFpEF, DM, SUMMIT, FLOW, SOUL, ESSENCE, SYNERGY, I love the names, right? All of it. So I think that let's dive a little bit deeper, but don't, I want you to think about these as clinicians of these, they took robust data and then said, how should we change our clinical practice to improve the outcome of the lives of people with diabetes?
Yeah. And I, you know, one of the things I really like about these guidelines are that they have the beautiful figures. So there's like 11 figures throughout, and it's things like how do you choose which pharmacotherapy, including the complication-centric, and then if there's not complications, you know, the other factors like cost and access or avoiding hypoglycemia. And they're very pretty to look at. Like, they're easy to understand. The guideline is also 32 pages, so it's very manageable. We love our ADA standards of care. That guideline's a little bit longer. And so I feel like this is very digestible. And then the commentary with it includes so many good nuggets. So yes, let's dive in and talk about some of these. I don't know that we'll be able to talk about all of the diagrams in detail, but I think at least starting off with the principles, which is what it first starts off with. And there's really 10 guiding principles. And I love number one is that lifestyle is the foundation for all therapy. I think we can't forget that with all of our latest and greatest medications. They talk about using a comprehensive approach for weight loss to achieve clinical goals. And in fact, there is a weight management diagram throughout that's in here that really talks about how you may select which medication to use. Then they talk about the choice of pharmacologic therapy is guided by glycemic targets and comorbidities, including, like you said, Natalie, like ASCVD, CHF, CKD, MASLD, OSA, or overweight and obesity. And choice of therapy considers ease of use and access, which we can't ignore, right? Like, we just absolutely can't ignore the access piece of it. Like, it just is part of care. And then number five is actually individualizing glycemic targets. And I think They've really embedded CGM metrics throughout here. So A1C, of course, but then including GMI, that glucose management indicator, which is the estimated kind of estimated A1C from CGM data, time in range as well. And maybe now they'll let you talk about the other five guiding principles.
Okay, wait, you have to stop because my pump was beeping.
Oh, no, I didn't even hear it.
That's a good thing, but it did. So can you just do the last two sentences again? And I can't talk. Did you put the principle? Did you put the link in the...
I could do, it's at the end of the article is the full, the actual guideline. That's what I'm using. I'm just using, I like actually sent that to you to look at the guide. Like it, there's a link to the actual guideline.
Yeah. I pulled it up on my phone. I just couldn't. Okay, there it is.
I could do them all. I just don't want to be a hog and talk.
But no, I can do them. Better let you don't do them all, right? Hang on.
Give me a second. I could turn it to you to talk about the pre-diabetes algorithm. It's up to you.
No, hang on one second. Let me just pull it up here. Oh, here we go. PDF. Boom. Sorry. I was on my phone and I was struggling. And I'm just like, I can't read and see at the same time because I'm, you know, I know you think I'm smart. I'm not that bright, right? Yeah.
So you went through five.
I went through one through five. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Right. Do you want to do five again because my pump was beeping or you think you didn't hear it so no one else would
eat? I honestly didn't even hear it.
Kind of has a panic moment there, right? Yeah.
Oh, okay. No. So
I don't
attempt it. To you.
Right. Exactly. Right. So number six, optimal A1C or GMI is less than 6.5 or as close to normal as safe and achievable. I think this is important, right? There's a little bit of a difference between ACE and ADA on this. ADA says less than 7, but less than 6.5, you know, when it's achievable. This is, look, can we push this? We have more systems and more drugs in place that allow us to get to those lower A1C targets safely without increasing the big thing is hypoglycemia, right? Avoid therapeutic inertia, you know, and get to goal as soon as possible, adjusting as a bare minimum every 3 months or even faster. So I think this is important. I think you and I see a lot of people who were started on 10 units of basal insulin and then sent to us, but they've had to wait a little while to get in and no one's looked at their numbers and no one's changed anything. And, you know, we can see 500 milligrams of metformin for years. Stop. Let's titrate up. Let's keep it safe, but let's get these medications that reduce, you know, cardiovascular outcomes as quickly as possible. I love that. Avoid hypoglycemia. You know, hypoglycemia is limiting in any given day. Right? Someone's driving and they're low. They don't ever want to be low again. So they then allow themselves to be 200 all the time. That's not what we want. But it's also unsafe for the people around you. And it's psychologically unsafe. People, once they've had one severe low glucose, really struggle with understanding that we don't have to do that forever. So avoid it. I love that just blanket statement. We're done. Number eight. Number nine, CGM is highly recommended to reach glycemic goals in adults with diabetes. We saw this in ADA recommendations this year of anyone with type 1, anyone with type 2 that is on insulin or a hypoglycemic agent or an agent that causes hypoglycemia. And then, of course, my favorite quote summation of that quote is, and anyone else that would benefit with type 2 diabetes, which to you and I, Diana, of course, is everyone. We believe in CGM for all. We need to use it so we can see behaviors. We can see what foods affect different people. We can see how exercise, love it. And then comorbidities and complications must be managed for comprehensive care. We cannot, you know, my expertise is diabetology, but I also manage the, what else? Blood pressure. When people walk in the door, is it, you're high the last three visits? Don't, you know, these kinds of things, lipids, are your lipids at goal? Do I need to use stronger agents, combination agents? These things need to be managed with every person that's seeing that person, not owned by one. I can't send someone to cardiology for lipids, right? If they're super high, if they've got familial hypercholesterolemia, there are some times that we absolutely send out, but we should be doing this in primary care and in endocrinology right now.
Well, lipids used to be really managed by endocrinology, and then it right. kind of became a cardiology.
But someone has to own it. What I hate is when no one's owning it, right? That's the hardest part.
Yeah. So, yeah, going along with these algorithms, so there's a really nice pre-diabetes algorithm, which definitely emphasizes weight loss, as well as looking at comorbidities. And for example, like we know certain agents like tirzepatide, for example, has an indication for obstructive sleep apnea. So that could be, you know, it emphasizes using that. Or in the case of MASLD, like semaglutide. So it specifically does call out some of these agents and emphasizes weight loss. But what I'm really excited about is this new algorithm. It's the next one. It's the diabetes classification algorithm. And we know there's so much misdiagnosis that there are many people that may actually have type 1 diabetes and get misdiagnosed as type 2 diabetes. And so they go through kind of the, you know, when should you suspect that maybe it's not type 2 diabetes. And so they have kind of what maybe is the more common phenotype, like when you've got someone, you know, associated with overweight and obesity, when there's a family history of type 2 diabetes or a personal history of gestational diabetes or signs of insulin resistance or elevated triglycerides and low HDL, then, you know, it seems to fit more of the picture of type 2 diabetes. But if all those things aren't there, then really starting to think, well, could it be, you know, could the person have some of the signs of type 1 diabetes? Like, were they ever in DKA? Do they have other autoimmune conditions like thyroid disorders, like Hashimoto's or Graves' disease or celiac? Do they have a family history of type 1 diabetes? Have they been on drugs like checkpoint inhibitors, which are associated with that? And if that's the case, then we should do a further workup. We should check for autoantibodies and check that C-peptide. But the other thing that I really love is that they also say, you know, what about there are some other forms of diabetes as well, right? Like you can have endocrinopathies. You could actually have, and actually speaking of the endocrinopathies, one of the things that's new this year that I think is very exciting is they've really addressed hypercortisolism. And so, you know, we know from the CATALYST trial that people, more people than we could have ever imagined, actually have hypercortisolism. It was about 23% in that clinical trial. And that increases, you know, it makes it very difficult to manage the diabetes if you don't address the excess cortisol. So our guidelines now, they go into detail about the CATALYST trial and about assessing for this. Natalie, you want to talk more about that?
Absolutely. I think when CATALYST came out, you know, we asked some of the people that did the research, what percent of people would you have guessed before this trial came out would have had hypercortisolism? And we all remember that picture in our textbook where this person has this larger body habitus in the gut. They, you know, they that classic moon face, they look like they've been on steroids for years, because that's what hypercortisolism is, right? This low or high, depending on the person, right? This exposure to extra cortisol. And that's what we all thought it was. We never thought it was common. We never screened for it unless they came in. And by the time they present with the picture in your textbook, it is so far gone. It is so late in the game. We don't want that. And so for ACE to call out hypercortisolism as referral to an endocrinologist in this difficult to treat, right? The CATALYST trial said 3 or more diabetes medications and still an A1C greater than 7.5. I mean, it's not much, right? That's, I would say half my patients have an A1C greater than 7.5 on any given day, right? And so I think that's important. Blood pressure that's difficult to control as well. 3 or more blood pressure medications. These are signs that something else might be going on. And so to call this out, to encourage screening. I just screened someone the other day who's had diabetes for 20 some years and her first labs came back all positive. And I actually have an answer for her now, right? I mean, we do need further testing. We're not really there yet, but this is telling me that we need to do more and not just keep throwing more medications on her. I think another way you and I have both talked about is when we're on these once weekly, very strong GLP-1, semaglutide, tirzepatide, and they're not at goal and haven't lost weight. And, you know, these non-responders that we sometimes see, these people I'm screening immediately for hypercortisolism because something's not working, right? It's a different mechanism and we need to explore that more and make sure the person is getting treated. A lot of times when we treat the hypercortisolism and we can find the source, then diabetes can really become easily managed or not needing to be managed at all, which is an amazing solution as opposed to what we're doing now.
Yeah. And you bring up a really great point about the blood pressure medications, because that often we see some resistant hypertension with that as well. And for those that needed multiple blood pressure medications in addition to the diabetes, the rates of hypercortisolism in Catalyst was actually 36.6%. So it was even higher. And the patients, like the inclusion criteria was like our very, I don't know, it was a very common patient population. So now that's definitely on the radar when someone's not at their A1C goal. And I think it's something we should regularly assess. We do it with the 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test. And so it's a pretty easy test to do for screening. And then if, you know, we generally should follow that up with additional with imaging to see if there's a source of the hypercortisolism. If there's not a known source or it's not really being able to be treated surgically, the Catalyst 2 studied the drug mifepristone and showed that when that drug was used, that there actually was able to really treat the hypercortisolism, and then lower A1Cs were significantly lower. So I am excited that this is like made it to the guidelines. And I think it's this diagram, especially about kind of what do you do next when your person, you're not sure the type of diabetes or how maybe they're not at goal and what else can you look for, I think will really help clinicians.
And it's the first one because the next several are more rare, right? Anatomic pancreatic disease, monogenic diabetes, you know, medication induced, right? So if they're on long-term steroids from transplant, post-transplant diabetes, right? Or checkpoint inhibitors, it's still way more common than any of the other, right? Or other mitochondrial maternally inherited diabetes. Those are much more rare than you know, this hypercortisolism, you know, high glucose is because of the hypercortisolism. So I love that it's first. I love that it's called out. I love that it's based on, you know, data from these trials that said, boy, were we missing the mark here? And we really were. So we're screening more and more. And you're right. It's not a hard screen. It's the overnight dexamethasone suppression test. So we have a handout. It's a tear sheet. It goes with the person. They take a milligram of dexamethasone, you know, around 11 o'clock at night, go straight to bed, get up, go to the lab in the morning, and we get the results pretty quickly. So I think that that's a really good call out because of the number of people you and I have both found positive when we would have never screened them a handful of years ago.
Yeah, no, definitely. And then kind of continuing on, so they also have a really nice chart about ASCVD risk reduction, and one on dyslipidemia and one on hypertension. And I mean, for most people, we're going to be using either a moderate or high intensity statin for cholesterol. But then, you know, it's got pretty clear guidance, I think, on then using ezetimibe and then when additional therapy is needed to reach the targets, really focusing on bempedoic acid or PCSK9 inhibitors or bile acid resins, and then times when triglycerides are really elevated, when we might use icosapent ethyl or fibrates. So, of course, the cardiovascular, you know, management is very important with diabetes, and similar with the hypertension, if there's albuminuria, using an ACE inhibitor or an ARB. And if there's not, then we can use the other first-line agents like a thiazide diuretic, like a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. And it does address, you know, kind of like, well, what do you do next if those things are in place, and using a drug like spironolactone for more resistant hypertension or a beta blocker, especially if there's other indications like heart failure. So those, I think, are very helpful.
I also want to call out both with the dyslipidemia as well as blood pressure, that lifestyle intervention is at the top, right?
Yes.
Goals, you know, the goals of blood pressure, for example, less than 130 over 80 for, you know, we don't want to drive it, or less than 120 over 70 considered for for albuminuria, right? But we don't want people so dizzy that they, you know, that they're not able to bend over and tie their shoe, right? But following the goals based on the person, based on their age. You know, I'm not going to treat my mom's blood pressure that low. She's in her 80s, for example, right? But as soon as that, there's the goals. They're patient-focused. They're patient-centric is lifestyle, both with dyslipidemia as well as cholesterol. We need people moving. We need people, you know, to eat more fruit, whole fruits, whole vegetables. You know, we have to remember that lifestyle is a fundamental treatment in every algorithm that ACE had written for all of these, which is pretty wonderful.
Yes, I completely agree. And the other thing I want to call out is just regarding blood pressure goals, because we saw this year ADA, while it's less than 130 over 80 for most, based on the BP Road study, they did call out that for those with cardiovascular disease or higher risk, we could have a goal of less than 120 over 80. And so ACE also pretty similar, less than 130 yep. over 80 for most, but they actually say, you know, you could shoot for less than 120 over 70, a diastolic of 70 for those that may be higher cardiovascular risk, including those with micro or macro albuminuria or those with some complications like peripheral vascular disease or retinopathy.
And I think we just need to remember that this is, you know, in the days where we remember 150 over 90, less than 150 over 90. Well, that's just in the last handful of years, right? We didn't realize how serious blood pressure was and how much of a problem it is. So we're trying to drive blood pressure down for a reason. We just have to be safe about it, right? So again, age matters. Is someone already frail? If they're going to fall and break a hip because they got dizzy, that's not what we're talking about here, right? We want to keep those guidelines in the back of our heads, but it is gone are the days when you see 154 over 85 and you don't say, how are your blood? I know you're high here. Let's redo it. Let's do it a second time before you leave. What were your last three visits before this? Do you have a blood pressure cuff at home? You know, those kinds of things so that we can get some good, you know, because everyone's like, well, I'm always high at the doctor, but I'm never high at home. Oh, do you own a blood pressure cuff? No. Well, then how do you know you're high at home, right? Like, are you not seeing spots and that's how you decide? So we need to be careful because I think because blood pressure, hypertension doesn't make you feel bad. Right? Just like an A1C of 7.9 doesn't really make you feel bad. So we need to help people understand why we're treating these comorbidities, because it's going to reduce your risk of overall complications from hypertension, from dyslipidemia, from, you know, diabetes, and all three of those together, and sometimes more overweight, obese, some of the other challenges can really cause problems very early in your life. And that's why we're doing it. But we need to remember that all of this is with who's in front of me and why.
So that's a really good segue into the complication-centric glycemic algorithm, which breaks down different complications. I mean, very similar to the way ADA does, where you've got heart failure, where we know SGLT2 inhibitors, and now we have evidence for certain GLP-1, basically semaglutide and tirzepatide, have shown benefit for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. That's called out in there. Similarly, it breaks it up with CKD, also showing SGLT2 inhibitors. And then, of course, we've got semaglutide with the FLOW trial. We also have ASCVD or high ASCVD risk, where we have GLP-1s as well as SGLT2 inhibitors. And then in their algorithm, they have stroke or TIA, where we have specifically called out GLP-1 receptor agonists. And in the footnotes, it shows like specifically semaglutide and dulaglutide have shown benefit for stroke. And then also pioglitazone, the TZD, is listed. And then also very prominently is MASLD, metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. This is also in the ADA algorithm, more towards the bottom of it. This one is very prominently, you know, at the top with all the other comorbidities, and pointing out a GLP-1 or dual GIP/GLP or pioglitazone have shown benefit. And then if someone does not have any of these comorbidities, then we go to the glucose-centric glycemic algorithm.
So I think when we see people newly diagnosed, we might see a lot of, you know, we don't have complications at this time. I think as we dig deeper into new patient visits, though, a lot of people already do have some complications, right? So I think we're going to be using the former versus this algorithm, which is, you know, we're looking at number one, lifestyle intervention. You guys, it's on the top of every graphic, and I love it, right? So we want to look at the comorbidities and complications, heart failure, CKD, CVD, stroke, TIA, mast cell. If yes, we use the algorithm 6, right? If no, then we look at person-centered selection of therapy. I love this. Who is in front of you? What kind of insurance do they have? What do we need? Do they have hyperglycemia? Is it very, very high? We're going to start with basal insulin, maybe basal prandial or basal insulin with a GLP-1. What a wonderful combination, right? You can give some background insulin and some GLP-1 to help cover those spikes from meals. If that person has a high hypoglycemic risk, or, you know, we would use metformin, SGLT2, GLP, GIP, you know, so we're going to pick based on who's in front of us. Overweight or obese, we're going to pick the stronger medications that help with, that at least, that either help with weight loss, are weight neutral, or don't, you know, so as opposed to weight gain. And then decrease access and need for a reduction in cost. I think this is really important. There are people who fall between the cracks, who make too much money to get any kind of patient assistance. You know, my system is a 403B hospital. We have a patient assistance program that's very robust, but there are people that don't qualify for that, but can't afford the copays for some of these medications, and the pharmaceutical companies, their programs, they fall through, right? So what can we use? How do we use it? And but I love that it's in there because you don't have to question it. But I would want to say that decreased access and need for decreased costs should only come after you've tried other methods, after you've tried patient assistance, after you've tried other things, because it is not the primary way we want to treat diabetes. You know, it's because we're using some of the medications like sulfonylureas don't reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes, right? Don't help protect your kidneys. Now, the A1C reduction certainly does help those things, but there isn't demonstrated cardiovascular risk reduction in those in some of the medications that we use.
Yeah. And to point out a couple other things, they do say if A1C is more than 1.5% above a person's goal, so if it was 6.5 is the goal, be over 8% to start with 2 agents. Now, I do think we know with some of our GLPs or dual GIP, GLP, that we can actually get more than 1.5% A1C lowering. But I think the thing to remember is it does take time to titrate those agents. And they mentioned this, Natalie, when you were talking about like the severe hyperglycemia. Like, yeah, it's possible maybe they won't need insulin long term, but we don't want to let them hang out with a 10% A1C for like several months. And it's going to take time to titrate the GLP-1 drug. So it's better in that situation, start with insulin. You can also start with the GLP, and then you can gradually decrease the insulin and hopefully get them off of it if possible. Or if not, start looking at, could it be a different form of diabetes? The other thing I want to point out is that kind of at the bottom, it talks about individualizing the goals. Like we talked about, like you might have a higher goal for somebody. But in there, it also says, it was got a couple things. So it has periodic diabetes self-management education. I don't love the word periodic. I'd like it to be a little bit more prescriptive. But if we follow the diabetes self-management education and support guidelines, we know it should be a diagnosis. It should be at least annually. And then other critical times like transitions of care or life-changing events. And then it also says,
I mean, yeah. I love this because, you know, people's lives change, right? Women have children. People go through times in their lives where they're more active, less active. Their jobs change. Their ability to exercise at different times of the day, their health changes, right? They end up with periodontal disease and they end up with a heart attack or these things as life progresses. You need to stop and see an educator and reassess where you are and what you do know. Especially, I find our patients come back, the people that see our diabetes team, our education team, come back and say, oh, so much has changed since the last time I saw the educator. And that is like everything to me because the medications are changing, the choices are changing. And so, you know, if we are truly supposed to be offering choice, I don't have that hour with a person in front of me as the prescriber. So I think it's really important to continue to encourage people to to do check-ins as they can, whether that's a group class, whether that's a one-on-one, whether that's with a dietitian versus a nurse versus, whoever they're seeing at the time. I think it's really important to call that out, because a lot of times they come back in a way better place mentally, as well as, more time and range, more at goal for different various things that they were seen for in the first place.
Right. And then the other thing it says is implement CGM as early as feasible. So we love that, right? We want CGM for all. We want it to be offered. So we love that they're so pro CGM. The next algorithm we want to mention, really not, I don't think much change here, is just the initiating and titrating insulin. And I think overall very similar in terms of how we're generally going to start basal insulin in someone with type 2 diabetes most of the time. And then kind of this stepwise approach for prandial insulin, starting at the biggest meal or the meal where there's the greatest increase, and then stepwise adding additional as needed. They do call out, looking for over-basalization with that basal insulin when it gets to more than 0.5 units per kilogram per day, or the BEAM score. We love the BEAM score, the bedtime minus the morning. And if the bedtime to morning drops by more than 50 points, we should start to worry about over-basalization, and that we may need to actually back off that long-acting insulin and instead add something with prandial insulin coverage. If a GLP-1 drug has not already been started, using that, and then adding prandial insulin as needed.
Yep. I think this is very similar to the past, titrate every 2 to 5 days. It will be interesting to see what happens with the once weekly basal insulins, right? We just had one approved this week.
So, yeah, and they actually refer to it in the commentary.
Yes, they already.
Right. Yes. So it's so up to date. It's amazing.
Exactly. Right. It's not actually in the graphic, but it is mentioned in the discussion. Yeah. Already, because they knew they were coming. I mean, we know that Novo Nordisk has been approved. It's expect for people with type 2 diabetes, the once weekly Icodec. And we expect, we hope at least, that Eli Lilly's once weekly Efsitor insulin is, to be approved hopefully later this year. So that will be a different kind of titration, right? So it more to come on that. But just so you know, that is out there, and we're excited that I'm sure ACE will update their algorithm as quickly as possible.
About it, how it's been approved in other countries, and about that being feature option.
They kind of work around it in that way of, hey, this is already out there and we're expecting it. And this is, and we're excited about it.
So for sure, we're excited. And then the algorithm really closes off with information about each of the individual agents and what their benefits are, what their potential side effects are, and lots of really good key pearls. Like, for example, which agents show the benefit for ASCVD, like heart failure, kidney disease, when you need to be cautious about renal impairment, hypoglycemia risk, what the effects are on weight, what the effects are on MASLD. And here we see that really it's quite robust the way that they've broken it down. They look at hepatic steatosis. They look at full-on MASH, fibrosis progression, and fibrosis regression, demonstrating, hey, did these show positive results or not? And then they also talk about GI adverse symptoms and then other considerations like the medullary thyroid cancer contraindication with GLP-1 drugs. And then access and cost, which is, I think, very, very nice, very comprehensive.
Yeah. And this is, so it's not individual drugs, it's drug classes.
Oh, right? Yeah.
So SGLT2 is a class, TZD is a class, DPP-4 inhibitors as a class, because we are, we could talk about different medications. Like this one's, even if we look at SGLT2 inhibitors, this one should be used at not less than GFR of 30. This one shouldn't be this one. But ultimately what we're doing, at least in our practices, of course, is using the one that's covered, right? Using the one that, You know, so there are some trials like flow and the preservation and the slowing down of kidney disease and, you know, tirzepatide with OSA, where there is a specific indication, but some of these are a little more. So what they did was they combined them all and said, where are we? What can we say as a whole? So ASCVD, for example, SGLT2 inhibitors said benefit, right? Same with for MACE, for GLP-1 GIP, same with GLP-1 RA. I mean, so it's like benefit, you know?
Yeah, they do though in the footnotes, they do get a little bit more granular,
but not in the which drug. Yep, exactly. So you got to read a little bit deeper if you're looking for specific molecules, that's all.
Yeah. And then they do, you know, just to kind of close this out, they have a nice profile as a pharmacotherapy for obesity where they kind of do, they have similar insight into each of them, focus a little bit more on adverse effects and cautions and contraindications. And then they also have vaccine recommendations, which I have to say, I really like the way they've split up the vaccine, like the vaccines, especially the pneumococcal, can get kind of confusing. I feel like the way they've laid it out is pretty easy to follow. So I'll probably start using their algorithm for that. And yeah, I think overall, I'm very excited about these guidelines.
Oh, I think they did a beautiful job. I love the graphics because they're easy to follow. And the commentary that went with it really does spell out the why behind each decision, which is wonderful.
Yeah. So, well, that's been a great discussion. We're very excited about the ACE guidelines. You can access them. They are free to all. And so they're in endocrine practice. And so we thank you so much for tuning in. And that wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.
Thanks, everyone.